Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Very conscious and very full of the fact that I was about to have my 70th birthday in June. And it was very much in my consciousness. I just was, I was thinking about it a lot. Everybody that I knew about it. I'm going to have my 70th birthday. It was very ego thing. I think at first I always loved to hear, oh yeah, look 70, I'm afraid that that's sort of one of the things that happens when you get to be 70, and I suspect it gets worse as you get to be 80, and if God so provides. Because I remember that's what it always seemed, oh, you don't look, you're 80. And I probably don't, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with me at all, except that I do lead a healthy lifestyle. It's just fortunate genes, that we're just lucky. But we still get ego involved. Ooh, maybe your age. And it also provided a lot of free meals. People took me out a lot, so that was nice. Some of them were even in this room that did that. And as I was sitting this morning, I was thinking about what it means to give this kind of talk. So in the tradition to which I'm attached, I guess, or trying to follow, the Zen tradition, this is not a Dharma talk. I'm not a person who should be giving a Dharma talk. I am a student, not a teacher. And so this would, in the tradition, be called a way-seeking talk. That is, the talk of one monk. So we can all imagine we're monks right now, sitting here listening. One monk to other monks about what the way means to them, how they found the way, how they found the middle way, whatever that means. So it's that kind of a talk and not although I have a book with me which I might use, not for me to expound on the Dharma. However, I just like to talk a little bit more about being 70. Now that I'm 70 in a month, I'm in my 80th decade. That has a resonance to it, And that sort of leads into the talk and what I might talk about in terms of the precepts. I've only been out for 5 years. I came out when I was 65. I was married for 35 years. I had a fairly good relationship with my wife. I love her very much. I'm not sexually attracted to her, and believe me, that was a problem, in our relationship. It's something that I know that some of the other men here also share with me, having been married, having children. I went through a very difficult experience in my life then, in that one of my children died almost 11 years ago of cancer, and that was a very profound experience for me, and probably one that nudged me into acknowledging that the Dharma and the way is something that's important to me, something I can't ignore in my life, as I tried to do for so many years. But the thought that I had, the thoughts that I've been having in this last few weeks or so, have been two major thoughts, two major ideas which keep coming up. One is that I'm really very happy. I'm feeling very good in general. Everything is really very nice in my life. I have the beginnings of what may be a very nice relationship. I've started singing a couple of years ago in the chorus, which I hadn't done for a long time, and I'm beginning to get comfortable with that, and I love singing, and My life is good, you know, in many ways. It's just very enjoyable. And the other thought I have, if this is happiness, like, it's not that great. I mean, it's not, you know, it's just not wonderful. It's somehow rather, well, you know, fireworks didn't go off or skyrockets or... it's because I still have the same vicissitudes, you know, that come up, you know, the same doubts. I was very doubtful whether I would even know what to say when I started talking to you. All the old pathways and the old habits, you know, many of them are still there, you know, the doubts, the confusions, the whatever. But I really sort of feel happy. I have achieved a lovely and pleasant relationship with my wife. We can now talk with each other. We're friends. I have a nice relationship with my son, the one who still is living, and I feel comfortable. And not only that, I recently decided to formally take the precepts, take the vows in the Zen tradition, and since then saying, why am I doing that? You know, it's going to be a pain in the ass, and whatever. With the other thought that I really have been doing it for all my life, you know, in a sense, been following the path. So, what I wanted to do, if I can find my glasses, here they are. That's sort of a way of my talking about myself. The main issue, of course, that I had in my life was accepting my sexuality. I mean, if I stayed married for 35 years and did not come out until I was 65, there are some issues about my sexuality, you know, there. One of the major ones, of course, is that I misused it. You know, the third precept, thou shalt not misuse sexuality. I misused it because I suppressed it. I denied it. I did not acknowledge it. So I was split off from myself. And I was in, and it affected my life in lots and lots of ways. Which keeps surfacing all the time. Just a very brief history, you know, when I was 24, I came out. You know, I started fooling around and acknowledging it and going to bars. And at 23, I went back in because I didn't like, it was just an awful thing that I was doing that, you know, it was, to me, that's how I felt about it. And I went and I started psychoanalysis, and of course I was being treated for my psychosexual disorder, which I acknowledged I had, and there were people who were willing to treat me for it. So, you know, I did that. And I did that for a long time. I did that probably 20 years. If you'd ever like to really read a good explication of that, Martin Duberman's book about his life is an excellent statement about the way you can beat yourself up about that, you know, the different ways, and the way that profession of psychoanalysis, which incidentally I was trained in and actually practiced briefly until it was just too much for me, because obviously I couldn't really help other people. I couldn't stay with people, that is, and stay concentrated with them, because I was had to set on so much of my own stuff. You know, so it was not possible for me to be very good when I was probably pretty good, but I couldn't take it. I had to quit. And I didn't go back into it till I was almost 50, which is about the time that I acknowledged that I was gay but decided I wouldn't do anything about it. You know, well, I'm gay. You know, so I won't do anything about it. I won't. I don't need to. I can deal with it. You know, whatever. So that's a very brief history of it. What happened is I retired when I was 64, and I had a wonderful house, and I had in a wonderful area, and I had a good amount of money in my retirement to live on. And it was, everything was wonderful, except it just wasn't, you know, it just got worse and drier. And my wife and I, we really sort of just stopped just being with each other. You know, we were bored, et cetera. So when I told her that I was gay and I wanted to have I needed to express my sexuality with men, is how I put it, because I didn't even know what that meant. I did, and she said, well, we can't live together anymore. And he also said, and that's why, huh? You know, meaning, so that's the reason. You know, I always thought I wasn't attractive or something like that. So that was the reason, you know, that sex was never anything that was very, wonderful. Which it was exactly the first time I had sex with a man after I came out. It was, that's what it's supposed to be like, you know. It was great. And I also started my first contact formally with Zen about 9 years ago, which was before I came out. So that's, and I know that had a great deal to do with it. And that's sort of, you know, the history. But I thought I wanted to talk a little bit about the third precept and it as a, and you know, the misuse of sexuality from the perspective of what we do with ourselves about our own sexuality sometimes, you know, how we live. But I just thought I'd just talk a little bit about the precepts. What is that? Because I know you've been talking about it here, or you had a talk last week about it, which unfortunately I couldn't hear. This is a book by Robert Aitken, who's a wonderful, wonderful teacher. Is anybody familiar with the work? Some of you have read it? This is The Mind of Clover. It's about the taking the precepts. Robert Aitken is a very easy to read, wonderful expounder of the Dharma, who is one of the earliest in the Soto tradition to have practice. He's retired now in Hawaii because he's over 80, but he's been an outstanding, you know, leader in the Soto Zen community in the United States. So he said, and I may be duplicating what you heard last week, I don't know. The precepts of Zen Buddhism derive from the rules that govern the Sangha, or community of monks and nuns, who gathered about the Buddha. The precepts are just rules for behavior. You know, they're just ways to look at human phenomena that we live with, that we have to have some perspective on how we're going to handle, integrate into our lives. That's my perception of it. And so the precepts came from rules, but the important thing is that the precepts, as I understand it, grew out of the community's need to have a rule about what to do about something. In other words, they didn't come from the mountain, and Moses didn't come and say, now, this is how you should live, God has said so. They rose instead in a much more organic way. At least I like to think about it. That's what I've been told. I wasn't there, so I don't know. But they rose out of, as the community gathered around him, as they practiced the teaching, they developed these rules. Because they had to have a way of handling things like sexuality and lying and gossiping with each other and all the other ways that a community, can develop. I don't know if any of you have ever lived in an intentional community, but I lived a couple of years in yoga and in Zen communities, and there's a lot of gossiping takes on, and a lot of stuff takes on in those places, and it becomes an issue, even though sometimes it seems an odd precept to, monks should not talk about each other is one of the precepts. Anyway, that's the basic one. And the other thing that for me is important is with the precepts, without the precepts as guidelines, Zen Buddhism tends to become a hobby made to fit the needs of the ego. Mm-hmm. And I'm very good at that. You can do a lot of picking and choosing and deciding, I don't want to do that way. I like to sit this way. I want to do that. You know, I could do that. And of course, one of the wonderful things for me about Zen is that this is how you do it. And so you don't have to engage in that you'd like to do it that way or that way. It sort of takes your ego out of it. Rules are seen by many, and by me also, as a chance to be angry about authority and somebody telling me what to do. But I see it in Zen as a way of sort of helping me set aside my ego. You know, I go in and I just do it. Selflessness, as taught in the Zen Center, conflicts with the indulgence that is encouraged by society. The student is drawn back and forth from outside to within the Zen Center, tending to use the center as a sanctuary from the difficulties experienced in the world. In Aitken's view, the true Zen Buddhist center is not a sanctuary, but a source from which ethically motivated people move outward to engage in a larger community. And that's, if you ever live in a Zen community or any community, you know, there are, it is a place which is a sanctuary for some people and a place to not deal with the world. And of course, that doesn't apply to Zen, that applies to all kinds of things. In my life, I've been a Unitarian. I converted to Judaism. I was ethical culture. I was a communist. I was a psychoanalyst. And other things. I was always looking for an embracing thing that would tell me what to do. Until I came to Zen, which won't tell me anything about what I'm doing. Just said, sit and get enlightened, and you know, and let your ego go. So the precepts are the three refuges, which I don't really particularly want to go deeply into. I take taking refuge in the Buddha, in the way, in the Dharma or the teachings, and in the Sangha, in the community. Just immersing yourself in these things and accepting them, and then the next three are. There are 16 of them, but usually we only deal with the last 10, which are the ones, which are the thou shalt nots, rather than the others. But the others are to renounce all evil, to practice all good, and to save everybody. That is to engage in behavior which is beneficial and saves everybody. But the precepts themselves, you know, are, I just quickly list them, you won't remember them, but I don't remember them. I have a hard time. Not killing, not stealing, not misusing sex, not lying, not giving or taking drugs. That is not engaging using substances to deny your consciousness. Doesn't mean not drinking a little bit. It's been modified. You see. Not discussing the faults of others, not praising yourself while abusing others, not harming the Dharma, that is not talking against it and misusing it, or in some cases that really means being a false teacher or thinking you know it when you don't know it, not indulging in anger. Doesn't mean not getting angry, it means not indulging in anger, you know, and not defaming the three treasures. But for me, the misuse of his statement about the misuse of sex has been very powerful for me, and I thought it might open us up for a discussion. He said the original title of the precept was "No Unrighteous Lewdness." You know, no lewdness which is unrighteous, in suggesting perhaps there is righteous lewdness. I don't know. Lewdness has a quaint ring in modern English, but its derivation is instructive in terms of how it means. It comes from an old English word meaning unlearned or implying boorish. I think it's a very interesting concept. No boorish sex. Think of that. Very interesting concept. It doesn't say no sex. It doesn't even say, you know, not deriving pleasure. There's no boorish sex. You know, interesting. He said that's a good precept about it. And he quotes one. He said Aitken was a real student of koan use, which is something I don't know much about because I don't take to it very well. But he said in his study of 5,500 koans, and these are all, you know, koans are, you know, statements which are enigmatic, which test your perception, which are given to you by masters, and you may stay with koans for a week, a month, a year, you know. There are all sorts of them. It's an endless kind of process. Koans, he studied them a lot. He says he knows 5,500 that he's read, or at least. He doesn't know of one koan. He only knows of one koan that has ever dealt with sex. And while it is tainted by stereotyped attitude towards women, which is true in the koan, it does rebuke the puritanical attitudes commonly associated with religion. So I'm going to read it to you. In ancient days, an old woman gave housing and food to a hermit over a period of 20 years. One day she sent her 16-year-old niece to take food to the hermit, telling her to make advances to him to see what he would do. The girl laid her head on the hermit's lap and said, "How is this?" The hermit said, "The withered tree is rooted in an ancient rock in bitter cold. During the winter months, there is no warmth, no life." The girl reported this to her aunt. The old woman said, "That vulgarian! To think that I made offerings to him for 20 years!" She drove away the hermit and burned down his cottage. I always love these koans because I never understand them. But this is what he said. While we may question the use of the niece as bait to test the monk's realization, it is clear by the final response of this aunt that fundamentally she too disapproves of the misuse of sex. The hermit was not responding to the human being who laid her head in his lap. He was using her to express his own ascetic, position. Is that clear? I think it's very interesting, very dynamic. It's using something that we could, that I, as being raised, raised by Victorian parents who are very puritanical about, sex didn't exist in our house. It's so easy to accept that from that perspective. You shouldn't do that. She should never have done that. That's just she's just engaging in lust. But it is the thing about koans is that you very often can take something that you might be tempted to look at negatively and turn it into a positive. In terms of what this does. Anyway, I just think that's very important thing. So the aunt calls him a vulgarian, a boor. Lewdness is boorish. Asceticism can be and often is boorish. Boorishness is thinking of just oneself. She drives him off and burns down his cottage. Fire is a dream symbol for sex, in Jungian sense. You don't belong here. Sex belongs here, is what she was saying, or at least acknowledgement of it. So that's, I just found that very interesting. I don't have much else to say, except there are a lot of good things in this particular chapter about sexuality, which have been very helpful to me in thinking about it. I think there was one other thing that I wanted to read. Oh, I won't. I don't know what else I might want to say in terms the way that I followed. The idea that I had about deciding finally after 10 years to take refuge in the Buddha, what that means is I will study the precepts now with a teacher. I will explain to her, how these affect me, how I see these in my everyday life, and really meditate on them. I have a charge to sit and meditate on them, to understand them. And just talk. There won't be any, ostensibly, I don't think there's going to be a right answer to these, that I'm going to say this is what it means so much as how it's exemplified in my life. What she has suggested to me to do is to look at unrealized karma that I have not yet looked at, that each one of them might bring, some things in my life that I might I've been in denial about, each one of them, because when I look at lying, I lie all the time, to myself, to others, subtly, stealing, you should, filling out my income tax is an interesting experience. I lie to a cop if he catches me, and I wasn't speeding, was I? There's all kinds of ways that I engage in lying, and in killing. I like meat. I need to eat meat really to be healthy. After a number of experiences with vegetarianism, it hasn't worked out for me. I've gotten sick because of it, and I tried every conceivable kind of way I could do it. As one endocrinologist said, your North European genes require meat. You know, and he said you wouldn't put an Eskimo on a vegetarian diet. He says then you shouldn't be on one either. And I won't even go into the others because I'd never gossip. You know. I'd never talk about why somebody did that. You know. And I never talk about my roommates and what they don't do in the room in the house. You know, to keep it clean, things like that. So it's going to be an interesting experience. But what will happen at the end of it is I will sew one of those. Why don't you show it to people? Roxu. Tell us what you did to deserve that. To deserve it. I'm being facetious. What is it? What did you do about that? I just thought everybody might like to know.
The day after Christmas, my mother and I went to Walmart or wherever it was and got the materials and so forth that we needed. She couldn't understand the pattern. I knew nothing about sewing, so we put our heads together and got most of it done in the first day.
That's wonderful. It's going to take me 6 months, they say.
It takes a long time if you don't know how to sew, but we... Before I asked you to say, I interpreted the pattern. She showed me what it wants.
And what is that? What is it?
Same it's a smaller version of the Buddha's robe.
Yes.
And it's what one receives when one does Jukai or receives the precepts. It also involves, I see it as formally attaching oneself to a certain lineage.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same as Shoken, which is formally attaching oneself to a teacher, but it almost is.
And the teacher wrote something on the back.
Vast is the rope of liberation, a formless field of benefaction. I wear the Tathagata teaching, saving all sentient beings, which is the verse you recite usually when you put it on. Mm-hmm. You receive a Dharma name, mine is Fushin, guardian of the mind. This was given to me by Gimpo Meza Roshi in Salt Lake City as a Dharma heir of Maizumi Roshi. The late Maizumi Roshi who started and led the...
In Los Angeles, right. Well, I'll do the same thing. And there'll be a ceremony, a very formal ceremony, in which I promise to do it. Then they'll give it to me and I'll put it on and I'll sew it. It's going to take me 6 months to sew it. I know that.
Jukai is the most demanding religious ceremony I have ever been through.
Mm-hmm.
Physically and in every other way. All that bowing.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see it as see it differently from, say, the Ten Commandments and thou shalt and thou shalt not. I don't see the precepts as externally imposed, mm-hmm. thou shalt not. So this is something one does voluntarily. I vow to do this. Mm-hmm. I don't have to. I decide to vow to accept this formula for living my life, mm-hmm. which for me helps.
Correct. Well, that's what I think
that's
the
fundamental difference between Western religion and the precepts that mm-hmm. probably needs to be pointed out to Westerners.
Okay. Thank you for sharing it. I had this image. This is the last thing I'll say. I had this image in meeting with another teacher. Because my teacher is actually living out of the city and only comes in once a month. And I had an image that for a good part of my life, the Dharma has been there in front of me. I almost see it like as a sort of as a pole, you know, just sticking out. And I don't mean that kind, you know, just this way. And that I've been around it, underneath it, on top of it, trying to read about it, understand it, but that I'm finally going to get into it. You know, that somehow or other, that's what it means to me. in terms of where I'm going, in terms of my path. And I don't know where it's going to take me, and I don't know how much longer I'm going to live. None of us know how much longer we live, so I don't know what's going to happen. So that's my talk. So I'd like to, I thought maybe there are some questions or some thoughts that you have, or any of this touched you. Alan, how do you stand up?
Yeah,
one, two, three.
How do you prevent getting attached to your rocket surgeon?
How do I prevent it? I don't have one yet.
Well, what do you have one?
Well, how will I know? I don't know what you expect me to answer. I mean, I don't, yeah.
Any sort of attachment is up for analysis.
That's right.
So, you sew a rakusu, maybe at the point of sewing the rakusu, you should burn the rakusu. I mean, there's an attachment involved in wearing the rakusu and using it every day.
I'm sure there will be. You know, I'm sure there will be. I'm sure that I'll get involved in it. First of all, I expect I'm going to get involved in the brightness of it because it has a pattern. Stitches are supposed to be very small and in a line. And, I mean, I've investigated a little bit. So I know there's plenty of opportunities to get perfectionistic about that. So that's going to be right there for me. And then the idea of... those of us who wear rakusus are somehow a little more holy than people who don't wear them.
But then again, that's something to look at. And there's your ego. It's another opportunity for you to watch what you're doing, whether or not you burn it or not. It's all about your perspective to it, which you can change, whether or not it's a container or it's burning in a heap on the floor.
Right. I suspect I'll do all those things. That's what I'm saying. Is that enough of an answer for you?
I wasn't expecting a final answer.
I suspect I will behave as I usually do about almost everything else. Yes?
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you for your talk, which I found very moving and meaningful for me. And I think the thing that I found that I find most meaningful in what you had to say is the openness and honesty. And as you were exhibiting that, it occurred to me that, I'll try to make sense of that in terms of Buddhist traditions, perhaps it's the counterpart of awareness. Can one truly be aware without also being open to others about what that awareness reveals? And there are, of course, many traditions outside of Buddhism, such as confession of many faiths. The other thing that I appreciated very much was your discussion about sexuality. Since joining this group some 4.5 years or so ago, I would raise this issue in relationship to Buddhism, and the response that came from the Sangha was generally, though it's been changing, was interesting initially, and it was, that was it. And you just didn't want to talk about it. I don't know why. And I also had an interesting experience with regard to that to share, though I don't know exactly what sense to make out of it. Yesterday, my partner of several years very kindly has helped me, pressured me to take all the boxes of photos that I have and put them in order and put them on albums, and he would help me. He did most of it, actually, but I could look at them and when they were, and so forth. And then I looked through the ones we finished, which aren't quite all of those, and there were many pictures in there of people that I've been sexually involved with, of which there have been a large number. And I discovered as I saw those that there were, for the most part, there were very loving feelings connected with that for people that I had relationships with for a night, a day, a month, 2 months, as well as the longer relationships. And so those were probably not the only ones. There were other relationships with people that were long-term, my parents and some close friends. So in some ways, it didn't seem consistent with the idea that sexuality or lust is bad. And yet there were all the others that weren't in there, the ones that didn't seem to mean anything. So I don't know what it means, but there it is.
Okay.
Just, first of all, I want to agree with Leah on one thing before we talk about came across as very heartfelt and genuine. I was particularly struck with your efforts to not act out your natural sexual feelings and going through this therapy and being married and so on. This is more of a common thing, of course. I see this whole recent campaign by the Christian far right in these newspapers to try to convince gay men and lesbians to get some kind of Christian therapy to kind of fight their feelings and get them married safely in a heterosexual relationship. And it's just so sad to see that and see how the people that fall for that and get involved in that, how damaged that they're going to be and how damaged it's going to be with the people that they married as well. It's just very sad to think that that kind of attitude has to prevail. And you're just one example of the damage that happens from that kind of attitude being imposed on other people. So and I respect you for moving through that and getting you know.
I always feel funny when people say, I mean, not funny. My thought about that with myself is yes. It's really been a big thing for me, and my life has been a major transformation, you know. And I guess the 5 years, the 70s, really like, you know, that hit me. But I had no choice but to come out, and I would be dead if I didn't come out. I really feel I would not be alive in this world. I would probably have cancer, or I don't know, whatever diseases that the body eats itself up with, you know, that can come from inner stress. I just couldn't live with it anymore. I had no more diversions. I hadn't got my job anymore. I didn't have the politics of the job that I had. I was at a university. I didn't have the support I got from my work, which I was doing. At that point, I was doing therapy and loving it. And I didn't have all those things, and it would have been. So I'd have no diversions. Yeah, go ahead.
How useful do you think a precept like the third one is if we can interpret it any way we choose and mold it to our own personal uses? For example, you know, just the gay versus straight aspect of it, or boorish sex versus...
What do you think about that?
Sex between monks.
What do you think about that?
I think that they tended to evolve out of not the central issue of Buddhism, the central essence of being as clear as possible. I think it evolved out of more the culture in which Buddhism arose from, the need to bring some of that culture that people were raised with into their faith instead of...
You mean you think it might be better if we didn't have anything about sex as a precept and any approach to looking at it? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the only mention of sex was that one koan, and the only mention of sex in the doctrine is something about the bad part of sex. There's nothing that says, take your sex and joyfully experience it as a part of being a Zen Buddhist, and there's none of that. It's only a thou shalt not, even in sort of a softer form. I don't see how helpful that is.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I find the idea that of boorishness, though, of not engaging in lewd and boorish sex, you know, helpful to me as a thought.
You feel that you're not boorish? So you somehow already put yourself on a level above boorishness?
No, I'm very boorish sometimes. No, I was saying the idea of having a perspective like that about it. Now, I wasn't thinking about it in that sense. I was thinking, one of the conundrums about Buddhism in general is that it doesn't say anything about sexuality, because they just didn't have rules about it. They didn't engage in it. I shouldn't say that. That's not true. The major tradition that doesn't impose celibacy on its monks and teachers is Japanese Zen Buddhism. Most of the others don't. Most of the others do. There's a celibacy tradition. You want to say something about this, David?
I think that really the precepts can be taken kind of as a whole, dealing with all the ways in which one's energy fields can affect other beings for good or for their good or their harm. And speech is one, by, you know, by opening your mouth and pushing air out in certain forms can have a real effect on people. But, you know, as odd as that is, you know, that you're just moving your lips and somebody can be enraged or calmed or enlightened. You know, that's astounding. The things you can move your hands in different ways, you know, jab someone with a poke, poke them with a sharp stick, or you know, or hug them. You know, so your actions can be this. I think it's just a way of saying that sexuality involves a lot of energy, and be careful with it. It's just like being careful with your sports. Be careful with all your activities that involve other beings, that they can be helped or harmed, and to use it. It doesn't say don't do it. I think it purposefully says don't be boorish. I don't know if boorish is an insult to some group. I think it is.
One perception about it is that. That it wasn't misused that much in Asia, that it was accepted more as an organic part of life, so they didn't have the concept. But I think in our society, that, and in my world that I live in, it's sexuality is something that needs to be discussed and needs to be integrated. And I'm going to try to have a Buddhist perspective on that, as I have about everything else that I might engage in. So I think it's helpful to have that. You know, does that, I don't know if that answers your question. I think that's because we in the Western world and in our country in particular, we do have to have some ideas about how we ought to be living with sexuality.
I agree with the previous caller.
And there's no charge, these are not even 900 numbers.
We don't discuss it enough. It's probably hasn't been addressed enough, at least for our modern sexual world.
Yeah.
And that's probably one of the aspects of Buddhism that looks like it might need to adapt or more light should be shown in that area.
Joaquin?
If I heard you, you said that you're engaged in a relationship right now?
Yeah. Well, it's just a beginning thing, but it's the first mature relationship I think I've had since I've been out. And I don't know what else to say. It's moving a very, very conscious way in terms of how we're. When we see each other and what we do together, and not with limits about sexuality, but a lot of consciousness about it, and I'm reminded because I have I was just talking last week to a friend of mine who came out just a year and a half ago, and is now has a partner, and he's got a dream boat of a partner. I mean, his guy's 50. What a cute guy he's got, you know. And I was saying, isn't it nice? And he's saying, no, it's not. I went into it too soon. I shouldn't have done it. I really didn't think about it. And I said, why? He says, because I want to have sex with 25 other people as well as him, and it's a real problem. He just said he went into it too quickly. So he wasn't conscious. I think as conscious as he should have been about what he was doing. So that's all I could. Does that answer your question? I don't know. What else do you want to know about it? You know, hopefully it's a reasonably mature relationship. Let other people speak.
Yeah. We're just about out of time.
Yeah, I know. We are out of time. I'm sorry about that.
I suggest that you introduce yourself and have everybody in.
I was going to do that, I was going to stop. I thought it was we had about 5 minutes to go. Sorry. Okay. Well, I'm Don Weeper. My name was in the program. I am the facilitator on every third meeting that we have.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.